A mother, a stepfather, and a dead father who from the grave imposes upon him the duty of purging the rottenness of Denmark. And Macbeth himself is the rottenness that infects all Scotland. We are fascinated by the feelings and motives and decisions, the psychology of Shakespeare's characters, but we are also made aware that their lives are interlocked with the health or the ill health of the societies in which they live. The characters of Shakespeare live out their private lives in public places. And their lives are dramatized in such a way that it is hard to say whether the private concerns or the public ones are the more important. Shakespeare deals not only with the private and the public, but also with the imaginative. Indeed, his ability to combine ordinary earthbound fact with imaginative vision is another of his characteristic talents. Let me give you two examples. In Much Ado About Nothing, the witty heroine, Beatrice, is happily jesting away when it occurs to her that she may be giving offense by speaking so frivolously in the presence of the prince, Don Pedro. So she says to him, "I beseech your grace, pardon me. I was born to speak all mirth and no matter." And Don Pedro replies, "To be merry best becomes you, for out of question, you are born in a merry hour." And she replies, "No, sure, my lord, my mother cried. But then there was a star danced, and under that was I born." When Shakespeare mentions childbirth, he always refers to the groans of the mother in labor. He never forgets the pain of delivery, which was unrelieved by anesthetics at that time. But it was equally characteristic of him that he should leap from the pain of the mother to the fantasy of a star dancing over his witty heroine's birth. He adapts the current belief in astrology, in which I doubt he put any serious stock, to make a charming and appropriate account of Beatrice's first moment on earth. Let me take a more sustained and serious example. This is Cleopatra in the last act of her play, mourning her dead lover Antony and preparing to face her conqueror, Octavius Caesar. She is speaking to one of Caesar's captains, Dolabella. "I dreamt there was an Emperor Antony. Oh, such another sleep that I might see but such another man. If it might please ye, his face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon which kept their course and light this little O, the earth. Most sovereign creature, his legs bestrid the ocean, his reared arm crested the world, his voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder. For his bounty there was no winter in it, an autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping. His delights were dolphin-like. They showed his back above the element they lived in. In his livery walked crowns and crownets. Realms and islands were his plates dropped from his pocket. Cleopatra, think you there was, or might be, such a man as this I dreamt of? Gentle madam, no. You lie up to the hearing of the gods." Now, it is understandable that a bereaved woman should romanticize her dead lover in this way. And natural that the worldly Roman soldier would keep a hold of reality. But Cleopatra's dream is based on qualities Antony genuinely had. He was a great general, and he was generous to his friends. He ruled half the known world, and although he was given to sensual pleasures, one never forgot his greatness, even when he wallowed in pleasure. His back showed above them like a leak-beaten dolphin. And the grandeur of Cleopatra is manifest in her ability to hold on to that vision of Antony, even in defeat. And if Dolabella is kindly in his soft denial of the dream, like a man speaking to a deluded person, gentle madam, no. Cleopatra is majestic in her rejection of his denial. You lie up to the hearing of the gods. This is not a petty matter. It is not a fib, a white lie. Antony's reputation is of universal import. This woman, who at times has been down to earth, flirting, scheming, deceiving, squabbling, brawling, is now preparing to meet death as a great queen. The romance here is as real as the ordinary daily facts. Finally, let me speak of the genre of these plays. 7 years after Shakespeare's death, two of his theatrical colleagues, actors named Hemings and Condell, gathered 36 of his plays together, only 36, they didn't quite get them all, and published them, collected in one large volume, a volume that scholars now refer to as the First Folio. They tried to organize the profusion of these plays by arranging them in three categories: comedy, history, and tragedy. The organization was reflected in the title they gave the book, Master William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies. Now, many modern complete Shakespeares follow this same arrangement, and I will follow it also in these lectures. I follow it because it is useful and suggestive. But it is not definitive. Shakespeare keeps straining at the bounds of these genres. The mixed nature of Shakespeare's plays leaps into prominence if we compare them with ancient Greek plays. Greek plays fly like arrows to their targets in under 1,500 lines each. A Greek tragedy, things start bad, get worse, reach bottom, and the chorus winds up by telling you the best thing that can happen to a man is never to have been born. Shakespearean tragedy, a great many people die too, but they do all sorts of other things. They triumph, they clown, they crack jokes. Hamlet is one of the wittiest characters in Shakespeare. In comedy, the Greeks cracked jokes, they told dirty stories, and they ended with a revel of food and wine and sex. And Shakespeare has those things in his comedies, but he also has serious things. Many people find Shylock a tragic character, even though he appears in a comedy. And Measure for Measure certainly deals with serious issues in a gritty world. As for the third genre, history, the Greeks didn't write plays of this mixed nature at all. It's difficult to say what constitutes a Shakespearean history play. Some history plays end happily for the leading characters, like Henry V. Others end with defeat and death, like Richard II. My point here is that the abundance of Shakespeare overflows the traditional generic boundaries. He is restless. He is experimental in the sorts of plays he writes. Life doesn't come packaged as comedy or tragedy. So Shakespeare strains at the boundaries of the traditional forms to get in as much as he can. No artist can reflect all of life. Art, after all, involves some selection from life, a selection manifesting a form either imposed by the artist or believed by the artist to be inherent in the material. But of all the artists I know, Shakespeare manages to get the most in and still be coherent. His prodigality, his abundance, gives us pleasures and griefs in a spacious plenty.
When I
was a graduate student and a young professor, I learned an enormous amount about Shakespearean comedy from the essays of the Canadian scholar Northrop Frye, and I still am deeply indebted to him. What follows, follows from Frye's theories. Comedy is concerned with desire. Desire and fulfillment. People are in a state of yearning, which of course entails a state of frustration, and eventually they arrive at a condition of satisfaction. Now, we desire many things. Food, money, freedom, pleasure, what you will. Shakespearean comedy concentrates on love, the desire for another person, which meets fulfillment in both spiritual and physical union. Shakespeare is the great playwright of romantic love, one of the great exponents of the idea or myth that for every young man out there, there is a young woman and they will meet and they will court and perhaps get through some difficulties, but they will marry and they will produce young of their own. Who will meet and court and marry and produce young of their own. The notion that romantic love is the normal prelude to marriage gains tremendous strength in the 16th century and, of course, has dominated the Western imagination ever since. Comedy, then, has a basic pattern that is related to the rhythm of the human race. The aesthetic philosopher Suzanne Langer pointed this out many years ago. The human race as a whole reproduces generation by generation. It works in the rhythm of renewal. This is as opposed to the rhythm of tragedy, where each of us individually rises to some peak or platform and then descends to death. I would add at this point that many people think, generally people who have not thought about the matter very much, that somehow inherently tragedy is more profound than comedy. I disagree with that. What is profound is an individual play. There are great and profound tragedies. There are also cheap and superficial tragedies. I've read some of them. There are likewise great and profound comedies. Twelfth Night and The Tempest have lasted four centuries by now. They're also cheap and superficial comedies. A movie you saw last week at the multiplex and won't remember more than another day or two. It isn't the form that is profound. Both forms are related to basic things in life. Desire and fulfillment for comedy, decline and death for tragedy. It's the individual plays that can be achievements. The plots of Shakespearean comedy concern the obstacles to fulfillment, the barriers that stand in the way. Usually the characters fall in love very quickly in Act 1. They are united in Act 5, so they spend the time of the play trying to get over, round, and through various obstacles. In some cases, those obstacles are external. There is a domineering father who says to his daughter, you may not marry the guy you want, I pick out for you this other guy. Or there is a law that stands somehow between the lovers. Or there is a rival lover, usually someone less attractive but more powerful within the society, who wants the desired object. This is the case in A Midsummer Night's Dream and As You Like It and The Merchant of Venice. In fact, A Midsummer Night's Dream is a very good example where there are all three occur. Hermia wants to marry Lysander, but her father says, no, you must marry Demetrius. Her father is backed up by a law in the ancient Athens in which A Midsummer Night's Dream is set, a law that says you must marry the man your father picks out for you, or you will die the death, or go into a convent. Pretty extreme law. There is the rival, because Demetrius, the man her father has picked out, does want to marry her. So she has all three of those things to struggle with. In other comedies, the barrier is internal. In Much Ado About Nothing, the sexual antagonism between Benedict and Beatrice is as great as the sexual attraction. And in The Taming of the Shrew, Kate is a raging termagant who is hostile to all the men she has met so far. Sometimes there is a failure in love. And when this is the case, it is always, nearly always, the man who is at fault. Most of Shakespeare's women are pretty steadfast in love and wise about love. Some of the men, however, Proteus in Two Gentlemen of Verona, Claudio in Much Ado About Nothing, Posthumus and Cymbeline, Leontes in The Winter's Tale, are fickle or skittish or easily deluded into thinking that the woman they love has been unfaithful when she hasn't. Now, from these possible obstacles come the major patterns of the plots of Shakespearean comedies. When the barrier is external, the characters usually cope with it by escaping the jurisdiction in which the barrier prevails. We begin in a city or a court, the characters run away. In Midsummer Night's Dream, they leave Athens and go outside into the wood, outside Athens. In As You Like It, the characters leave for the Forest of Arden. In a place closer to nature, they may work out their relationships undeterred by the power of the father or the law. When the barriers are internal, the pattern is not escape, but invasion. The home city is caught in a state of deadlock. What it needs is fresh people to come in from outside, fresh characters to upset the deadlock. In The Taming of the Shrew, Padua is caught in a state of deadlock. Everybody wants to marry Bianca, but her father has said her older sister, Kate, must marry first. Nobody wants to marry Kate, so everybody's unhappy. We need someone to come in and woo Kate. This is also the case in Twelfth Night. Duke Orsino loves the Countess Olivia, but she has vowed to honor her dead brother by 7 years of ritual mourning, which leaves the Duke mooning around in hopeless melancholy with no one to address his passion to. Illyria, where they live, is locked in entropy. What it needs is outside people to come in and establish new relationships. Those outside people turn up as the shipwrecked twins, Viola and Sebastian. One other generalization I must get into before I discuss Twelfth Night in detail. Shakespeare's special insight into love. For him, pretty regularly in the comedies, love has this unique and paradoxical quality. It is both foolish and wonderful. We behave foolishly when we're in love. We sigh, we pine. Life is not worth living unless we're with the beloved or thinking about the beloved or trying to get to the beloved. And other people laugh at us. At the same time, love is wonderful. It is the most profound experience a young person can undergo. Short of being mixed up in some catastrophe, some war, or the early death of one's parents, or something truly dreadful, love is the most moving, the most changing experience a person in the late teens or the 20s can undergo. The discovery that there is another soul out there that fits our soul, another person we admire that admires us, a profound and personality-altering and life-altering experience for most of us. And this combination of folly and wonder means that a comedy about romantic love can be both funny and deeply moving. One of the reasons why love looks foolish is that it produces highly artificial behavior in lovers. Courtship is an extremely stylized set of actions. This is another great paradox of love. To the lover, love feels natural. What could be more natural than the response of desire to a desirable person?
Desire is an instinctive response. The biologists would say it is a hormonal response. The pheromones start vibrating in the air between two people. That's why Shakespeare can so often use the plot of Love at First Sight. But however spontaneous and genuine the emotion feels, the expression of it is very sharply codified. Love needs a language, a set of behaviors. The first product of love is artifice. Every society I know of has invented a standard code of speech and action, conventions that are thought appropriate for young lovers. After all, in decent society, you can't just jump on the person you want. You have to approach and speak and behave in a particular way. For example, early in the 20th century in America, a young, well-brought-up, middle-class American man would court a young woman by formally calling on her at her house. He might sit on the front porch with her. He might bring to her some small gift of flowers, a slim volume of poetry, something small. You don't want to suggest you're going to buy the girl or something like that. Just an expression of your feeling. And the conversation would be discreetly chaperoned by her mother or her aunt, not sitting on the porch with them, that's a little gross, perhaps sitting in the front room, not even seeing them, but hearing occasionally the conversation through an open window to make sure the proprieties were being observed. Now, we don't do that anymore. It seems silly to us now. We don't have chaperones. We probably don't have front porches. And young people courting now think that they behave far more freely than their grandparents or great-grandparents did. And in some ways they do. But in fact, we have a different set of conventions that are equally rigid. I look at my students at college courting. What do? They go to the campus cafe or to some eatery downtown, and they order tacos and Diet Coke, and they sit at the table gazing into each other's eyes, and they proceed to analyze the psychological ramifications of what they call our relationship. They talk about their needs and their anxieties and their inhibitions and how their parents brought them up and the struggles they are going through. The Coke and the tacos aren't obligatory. Beer and pizza would do as well. But the psychobabble is obligatory. It's the language we have for love these days. Now, if you were a young Englishman at the end of the 16th century trying to express your spontaneous and overflowing passion for a young English woman you'd met, you would take your language and your conventions not from diluted Freud, but from art, especially from literature. In As You Like It, in The Seven Ages of Man's speech, Jaques describes the characteristic behavior of the lover as sighing like a furnace and making a ballad to his mistress eyebrow. A ballad, a song, in praise of some feature of his mistress' beauty. Or if you can't sing well, a speech, either to be written out in an elegant hand and delivered by a messenger, or to be recited orally when you see the lady. And these compositions are written in elaborately rhetorical prose. Really fine composition. And they invariably draw on classical mythology, the love affairs written up by the Greek and Roman poets, particularly one Roman poet, Ovid, whose collection, The Metamorphoses, was a convenient anthology of all the famous classical stories. Lucentio in The Taming of the Shrew, Benedick in Much Ado About Nothing, Orsino in Twelfth Night, Orlando in As You Like It, they all refer to one myth or other, Leander being drowned as he swam across the Hellespont on his way to see his beloved hero, or Dido pining for Aeneas as he sailed away to found Rome, or Troilus and Cressida pining for each other, separated by the armies at Troy. And if speeches and song are not enough, and you have real literary talent, you write sonnets. And sonnets have a very standard form. Not only the 14-line and particular rhyme scheme, they have a very standard language. The sonnet is almost always uttered by the man, and he speaks of himself as burning and freezing alternately, in hope and in despair, swearing he'll die if his mistress doesn't grant him mercy. And he describes the lady in an elaborate language of praise, which is very set, very formal. The lady always has a white hand, whiter than snow. Her hair is like fine-spun gold. Her eyes shine like the stars or the sun. Lilies and roses war in her cheek. Her lips are like coral. Her teeth are like pearls. Her breasts are like globes. Spontaneous feeling, upheaving within the lover, produces very scripted role-playing of one kind or another. Now that is how Orsino is behaving in the first scene of Twelfth Night. Act 1, Scene 1. Orsino has sent yet another messenger to Olivia, and Olivia rejects the messenger at the gate, will not even listen to the message. She's going to go on mourning her dead brother, and Orsino is melancholy and simply meditates upon his feelings. Oh, when mine eyes did first Olivia see, methought she purged the air of pestilence. That instant was I turned into a hart, that is, a stag, and my desires, like fell and cruel hounds, ever since pursue me. Olivia is so beautiful, she is so radiant, that she purges the air of all pestilence, all the plague germs around. She clarifies the atmosphere. And then the business of, when I saw her, I was turned into a stag, and my desires pursued me like hounds, is a deliberate allusion to a very famous Greek myth out of Ovid, the myth of Actaeon. Actaeon was a hunter who, while out on the chase, accidentally stumbled across the goddess Diana, who was bathing in a pool. Now, Diana is a virgin goddess. She has nothing to do with men, and she was outraged that this male mortal should see her naked. Therefore, she transformed Actaeon into a deer, and he was run down and killed by his own hunting hounds. And that story is moralized throughout the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance as a story about how desire unsatisfied will devour the desirer. If our desires do not reach fulfillment, we are torn to pieces by them. Orsino's suit has been rejected by the Countess Olivia. He tries one more time. The shipwrecked Viola turns up in his court in male disguise, dressed as a page boy, calling herself Cesario. And this Cesario is employed by Orsino once more on embassy to Olivia. He sends Cesario, thinking that the freshness and youth of the page boy may cause the Countess to have a change of heart. And it does. It causes the Countess to fall madly in love with the page boy. And the scene in which they first meet is one of the best demonstrations of characteristic action in love in Twelfth Night, and I will spend the rest of this lecture on it. Essentially, Cesario does three things. He comes with a prepared text, the kind of speech of praise that I have been saying is characteristic of 16th century lovers. I'm going to call Cesario he because he's supposed to be a man, but it's really very confusing. You don't know whether to say he or she. The androgynous appeal of this person works, in fact, both for Olivia and Orsino. It's one of the rather magical things in the play. Cesario begins, most radiant, exquisite, and unmatchable beauty. But then he interrupts himself. Olivia has several ladies-in-waiting around and is wearing a veil. He doesn't know which one Olivia is. So he undercuts the formal convention himself of making this speech of love and says, I pray you tell me if this be the lady of the house, for I never saw her. I would be loath to cast away my speech, for besides that it is excellently well penned, I have taken great pains to learn it. You see what's going on? There is the formal behavior of love here, but the messenger himself is making fun of it and saying he's not going to waste his efforts on it. He's not behaving like the standard lover, and that rather interests Olivia. Instead of getting just another suit from Orsino, just another fancy piece of verse or prose, we've got someone with some personality. As the conversation goes on, Cesario tries once more to deliver this speech of praise. By this time, they've gotten rid of the ladies-in-waiting. And Olivia says, "Now, sir, what is your text?" "Most sweet lady." "Oh, an excellent text, and much may be said of it. Where lies your text?" "In Orsino's bosom." "In his bosom? In what chapter of his bosom?" "To answer by the method, in the first of his heart." "Oh, I have read it. It is heresy." Now Olivia's mocking the convention of delivering a formal speech. She's treating it as if it were a sermon. You've got a text? Okay, what's the chapter? What's the verse? "Oh no, you can't build a sermon on that chapter and verse. It would be heretical." Both of them are mocking the method. Something is beginning to happen between these two people. That's the first stage, to set up the formal convention and start to undercut it. The second thing that Cesario does is to talk in two different voices. And this is why I mentioned the androgyny in particular, because one voice is that of a man, and the other is that of the woman whom Cesario really is, Viola. When Cesario asks for Olivia to take off that veil, "Good madam, let me see your face," Olivia hesitates and then finally does take it off. "Look you, sir, such a one was I this present. Is it not well done?" And Cesario replies, "Excellently done, if God did all." I think that's a wonderful line. The excellently done is the voice of a man who genuinely admires this womanly beauty. The "if God did all" is a woman's voice saying, "My dear, is that all you? How much of it is cosmetics? Let me look a little closer." And that double voice thing happens a little bit later in the scene when Cesario gets rather exasperated with Olivia. "I see you what you are too proud. But if you were the devil, you are fair." The first line, "I see you what you are too proud," is a woman's insight into another woman's vanity. After all, Viola knows she's already falling in love with Orsino herself, and she's sizing up the competition. The next line, "But if you were the devil, you are fair," is a very masculine kind of line, a guy saying, "By gum, she's pretty." Both voices are going there. So the scene becomes quite electrical in its sexual relationship. The third and most important thing that Cesario does in this courtship scene is to rebuke Olivia, to rebuke her quite stiffly for secluding herself from human relationships. And in that rebuke, she advances a theory that lies at the heart of all Shakespeare's ideas about love. Cesario tells Olivia, "What is yours to bestow is not yours to reserve." And in a later speech, "Lady, you are the cruelest she alive if you will lead these graces to the grave and leave the world no copy." That is, you are a very cruel woman if you will die a virgin, not having had a child who will carry on your beauty to another generation. Now, these rather odd compliments, you are beautiful, therefore you should reproduce. What is yours to give, to bestow, is not yours to reserve, to hold back, are based ultimately on a fundamental text in Western civilization. They're based on the parable of the talents in the Gospel according to Matthew. As the story is told in Matthew, a rich man went off on a long journey, leaving three of his servants with sums of money. 10 talents for one, 5 for another, 1 for the third. And the 10-talent servant went out and invested his money, and when the Lord returned, was able to give him back 20. And likewise, the 5-talent man doubled his. But the 1-talent man buried his in the ground and returned only the single talent. The first two servants were praised. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. The third servant was rebuked. Thou wicked and slothful servant, you will be cast into outer darkness. Now, the point of this parable, as it is understood in Shakespeare's time at any rate, is this, that we do not own our possessions, our merits, our virtues, our graces, the things we are given by birth, anything that can be called a talent. This, by the way, is the where the word talent in modern usage comes from, in all the Western European languages. In the original Greek of the Gospel, it's simply a sum of money. And because of this parable, it has come to mean any gift, any ability that we are born with, whether it be beauty or an artistic skill or a business skill or whatever. We do not own these things. They were given to us by God. We are only stewards of them. We hold them in trust. It is our job to put them to use in the world. A virtue, a grace, a skill, an ability does not fully exist unless it is put into action. It merely withers away. Now, this is a general Christian idea. It is still in practice. In an Episcopal church, when the collection is taken up, the congregation recites together, "All things come of thee, O Lord, and of thine own have we given thee." Of thine own have we given thee. That's our job, to give God's gifts back to him, to make God's gifts work in the world on his mission. And it was a doctrine particularly important in the 16th century in England. In the English Renaissance, there was a general turn against the enclosed monastic way of life. Henry VIII abolished the monasteries. And he did it, of course, for personal gain, and for political reasons. But he was able to do it. The population went along with it because there was a general sense that the monastic or conventual way of life, the enclosed, cloistered way of life, was not the highest way for people to use their abilities. They should go out and work in the world. Young, humanistically educated, able people should be active in the world. A life of prayer and contemplation is okay if you're old. This is what you do toward the end of your life. But young people ought to be active. Now, by translating this idea of stewardship into the highest realms of religious thought, I may be overplaying my hand, or it may sound that way to you. After all, Viola is only talking about Olivia's physical beauty, not her moral virtues. But the idea is pervasive in Shakespeare. Not a message that he wants to preach, just part of his basic mental equipment. Excellence of any kind must be given generously to the world, shared with the world, or it loses its value as an excellence. And that includes beauty. It is selfish merely to sit and look in a mirror, or to enclose yourself in a self-made cloister, as Olivia is doing. Our talents are the gift of God and nature, and we must render an accounting for our use of them. Olivia should not be living a barren life. And in fact, the effect of this scene is to persuade Olivia of this truth. Within the next 60 lines, she falls head over heels in love with Cesario, agrees that ourselves we do not own, I am not my own to seclude, and starts giving him gifts. All the real lovers in this play act with extraordinary generosity. The effect of Viola, this androgynous, charming creature, is to cause Olivia, and in a later scene, Orsino, to undertake a journey from self-absorption to generosity, from self-absorption to a reciprocal love with other persons. Several years back, a film version of Twelfth Night came out, directed by Trevor Nunn, with Imogen Stubbs as Viola and Nigel Hawthorne as Malvolio. It's a very good movie. I do recommend it. The New York Times, reviewing it, had to struggle a bit with the plot of Twelfth Night. In fact, the reviewer referred to it, to the plot, as being a Renaissance ramshackle plot. Apparently, it was a bit too much for the New York Times that there are identical twins and a sex disguise that is successful, and switching about of lovers and so forth. I will talk about realism and fairy tale qualities in Shakespearean plots in another lecture in these series, in this course. But I want you to know at this moment that Shakespeare is perfectly well aware of the improbabilities in his story. In fact, he writes for Sebastian, Viola's twin brother, a soliloquy that acknowledges the unlikelihood of what is going on. Sebastian has turned up late in the play, just in time to take over the man's role in Cesario's love affair with Olivia. Olivia, to him, a totally strange but beautiful, rich, and desirable woman, has swept down on him in the street and said, at last I have found you, come and marry me. Sebastian is responding to this extraordinary development. This is the heir. That is the glorious sun. This pearl she gave me. I do see it and feel it. And though 'tis wonder that enwraps me thus, it is not madness. Where is Antonio, then? I could not find him at the Elephant, and yet there he was, and there I found this message that he did range the town to seek me out. His counsel now might do me golden service. For though my soul disputes well with my sense that this may be some error, but no madness, yet doth this accident and flood of fortune so far exceed all instance, all discourse, that I am ready to distrust mine eyes and wrangle with my reason that persuades me to any other trust but I am mad, or else the lady's mad. Yet if it were so, she could not sway her house, command her followers, take and give back affairs with their dispatch, with such a smooth, discreet, and stable bearing as I perceive she does. Shakespeare has Sebastian acknowledge the bizarre quality of events, the unprecedented accident and flood of fortune, and has him work out an argument for Olivia's sanity. She rules her house well. She takes and gives back affairs with a smooth, discreet, and stable bearing. She must be sane. That's his concession to realism here. But the point of the soliloquy is really Sebastian's openness to experience, his readiness to embrace new developments. He is eager. He welcomes the good things of life. It is not just the sun up there. It is the glorious sun. And the sun is glorious, unless we are so jaded or so self-absorbed that we've forgotten about it, that we take it for granted. He describes himself as enwrapped with wonder. And he is. That such a thing as the sun should exist, that the air should exist, that pearls exist, that a beautiful woman like Olivia exists. This is a vital part of the view of life in Shakespearean comedy, that life is wonderful and to be embraced. And Sebastian's soliloquy is all the more impressive because of where it comes in the play. The middle of Act Four, directly following the scene in which Malvolio has been confined to the dark. Malvolio is thought to be mad and put in a dark house, which was the customary medical treatment for madmen in Shakespeare's time. Sebastian is in the sun. Malvolio is in the dark. Now, Malvolio really can see nothing beyond himself. He cannot see or appreciate other things. His only interest in the sun is that it enables him to see his own shadow. Mariah, Olivia's lady-in-waiting, has a line about him doing that. He hath been yonder in the sun, practicing behavior to his own shadow for this half hour. Behavior means courtly gestures, bowing, gestures with the arms, flinging the cloak around. Now, Malvolio is the center of the second plot of Twelfth Night. He is the steward of the Countess Olivia, and he is tricked into believing that the Countess is in love with him and will marry him and thus make him Count Malvolio if he courts her in yellow stockings and crossed garters. Before I talk about him personally, let me talk about servants here in general. Because we live in an age and culture that largely does without servants, we are apt to misconstrue their position and think that all servants in the 16th century are menials who scrub pots. No. The Elizabethan country house is a very large establishment. It would be an estate of thousands of acres, with farms and tenant farmers and all sorts of people dependent on it in various ways. An Elizabethan manor house was the center of the social and legal and agricultural organization for the whole district, probably for the whole county. That's where the title of count and countess come from. The upper servants in such an organization were vital and responsible people. They would not be peasants. They certainly wouldn't scrub pots. They might come from the ranks of the lesser gentry themselves. And the gentry are the top 5% of the population in Shakespeare's time. Probably that is the case with Mariah and with Malvolio. Malvolio is called a gentleman, and Mariah is referred to or addressed by Malvolio as Mistress Mary. They might be, say, the younger son of a gentleman, the one who didn't get the inheritance, of course, and the younger daughter of the one who didn't have enough dowry to attract a husband or something like that. The younger offspring of gentry, of good family, but no particular fortune, who would make a career in service to the really great lords. Malvolio is the steward. He runs the whole estate. He has charge over everything, keeps the books. If this were the 20th century, we would call him an estate manager, and he would probably have a degree in business or law. That's the kind of rank we're thinking about here. Olivia has great respect for him. When told that Malvolio has gone mad, she is very disturbed. I would not have him miscarry for half my dowry. And since her dowry is her whole estate, she's the only heiress, that's a considerable amount. He's a figure of visible importance on stage. He would have a steward's staff in his hand and a chain around his neck, a chain of office. He's very good at his job, devoted to the countess, carrying out the business of a household very carefully. And a great household needs such a steward. Sir Toby, the wastrel cousin, who just gets drunk every night, says in his first scene, care is an enemy to life. And that is very true. Being burdened with cares means you don't enjoy yourself. But so also one might say carelessness is an enemy to life. Both views can be taken. If you do not take care of an inheritance, you will end up like Sir Andrew, who has a small inheritance, but is going through it very rapidly. Mariah describes him as a very fool and a prodigal. Here is one of the great oppositions that occurs in a number of Shakespearean plays. I'll come back to it when we get to Falstaff. the opposition between merrymaking and devotion to duty. In this case, in Twelfth Night, the opposition gets into the title of the play itself. Twelfth Night is one of the great festivals of the Elizabethan year. It is the Feast of the Epiphany, January 6th, the twelfth night of Christmas. And as the Elizabethans did these things, Christmas was kept as a religious occasion. The big parties and the gift-giving happened on New Year's and Twelfth Night. Twelfth Night in particular was an occasion for games and putting on plays and other entertainments. And the merrymaking and festival that are associated with Twelfth Night as an occasion in the Elizabethan year are embodied by Sir Toby and Sir Andrew and Maria and Fabian and the clown, the jester, whose very name recalls the idea of festival. His name is Feste. And when they have that impromptu party, in the second act, the party that Malvolio tries to close down, saying it's too loud, it's too late, you're all behaving in an unbecoming way, then we have the full opposition between the spirit of festival and the spirit of repression. Carnival versus Lent. Malvolio is a Puritan. Now, this is a very interesting point about Malvolio. Maria, in fact, does at one point call him a kind of a Puritan. Then, five lines later, she says he's not a Puritan at all, but merely a time server, time pleaser, and an affected ass. He is and is not a Puritan. Shakespeare's being very careful with a volatile contemporary subject. For the Puritans, whom I've already mentioned in an earlier lecture, were the left wing of the political and religious spectrum. And they were a powerful group, both in the city of London and at court. They desired to carry the Reformation further, to purify the church, to do away with some of the remaining elements of Roman Catholicism that still existed in the Church of England, like bishops and elaborate ceremonies. They desired to create a holy, virtuous commonwealth to build the New Jerusalem. Now, Malvolio is not a Puritan because he has none of that true Puritan zeal, religious devotion. He is a Puritan in the sense of being repressive. He has all that hatred of holiday and reveling. He is virtuous, negatively virtuous, and so desires to set the standard of virtue for other people. Toby asks him the crucial question, "Dost thou think that thou art, because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale? Because you are virtuous, shall we do away with all the things that are fun, all the rest of us? Cakes and ale are central to all festivals." Indeed, Malvolio's concern with order, with decorum, with not getting drunk and staying up too late at night, with virtue, is particularly repressive because it coexists with a monstrous indecorum in his own soul. He desires the Countess. Now, that's not bad in itself. There's nothing wrong with that. The Countess is a desirable woman.